With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ladies and gentlemen,
can I please have your attention?
Can you dig it?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by the Dispatch, Dispatch Media. It's been a bad morning. If you follow me on Twitter, you probably know. In fact, where are you going, Zoe? Zoe just walked out of the room when I started talking about it. I had to bring Pippa, the English Springer Spaniel, to the vet, and she's going to get a bunch of tests to see if, in fact, surgery is warranted or if there's some other thing going on. We got a second opinion, and the second opinion was that her problem may be more systemic, but it could be also tick-borne and therefore maybe treatable medically, or who knows. Anyway, we didn't want to have, do surgery, which is awful, which would give her a permanent limp if it wasn't absolutely necessary and, actually fix the problem. So she's back in for more tests, but Pippa hates the vet more than any dog I've ever had. And I've never had a dog that liked the vet, but like she, Zoe, come on, go. She just starts to cry and whimper and shiver and, hold on, I'm going to... Zoe, I'm putting you out. Come on, go. Sorry about that. I don't know if we'll keep that or not, but Zoe was getting needy and schnozzelating my arm while I was trying to talk. Anyway, so Pip is there. She freaked out. She started crying. She got all up in my lap and wouldn't leave. And her being upset got Zoe upset. So I was basically sitting there in the car with two dogs demanding all of my attention, waiting for a tech to come out and take one of them away. It was unpleasant. And I don't think anyone is shocked at this point to know that I'm just a big softy about this kind of stuff. All right, but enough about the dogs, because some people, for reasons that baffle me, don't want to hear about dogs. What else? So, one of the things in news yesterday was like all but nine Republicans voted to deny a contempt charge against Steve Bannon for his refusal to deal with respond to a subpoena. I've been actually actively looking to see if there is any actual principled argument, no matter how far-fetched, that makes any sense to me on why you would deny, why you would vote that way. And I can't think of one, can't find one. It is ludicrous in every regard. And, it's going, as you guys know, I am a big, obsessive about how Congress has gelded itself and doesn't know how to be Congress anymore. It's sort of like, people who keep wild animals from birth, in their, on their property, and they raise them, raise tigers or chimpanzees or elephants or whatever in captivity. And then someone tries to just let them free in the wild, and the poor things don't know how to be wild animals anymore. That's sort of what Congress has become, in the sense that they just don't know how to be the institution they were intended to be. I'm not sure it's true of all 435 members, but it's true of a huge chunk of them. I remember making the point on Special Report a couple of weeks ago about the, you know, how all, you know, everyone was saying, oh, this is great, this haggling about the infrastructure bill, this back and forth. You know, this is what the process looks like. This is, you know, this is getting back to, you know, the way, you know, legislation is done. And I made the point, well, no, it's not. It's just vaguely looks like the kind of dysfunction we had 10 years ago. It's not how it's supposed to be done. You know, this stuff is supposed to come up through committees. I mean, I wrote about this not long ago. I think I talked about it on here. I don't know. You know, the way you do legislation is you find a problem, you bring it to the attention of local officials. The local officials talk to their congressmen and all that kind of stuff. Congressman writes a bill or makes a proposal to write a bill, and they debate it in committee. They bring in witnesses who talk about it, who say, no, this really isn't a problem, or no, this really is a problem, or really this is a problem, but it's this other thing that is the cause of this problem. And they kick it around and they talk about whether that it's worth spending the money required to fix it. And then it goes out of, and presumably if they win those arguments, it goes out of committee. And at some point it goes onto the floor and it's debated and it's haggled over between the appropriations people and the Commerce Department, blah, blah, all this kind of stuff, right? What we have now with the way infrastructure works is you have the Speaker's office basically writing legislation and then delivering it to like Moses down from the mountain, delivering the legislation to the people, to the Democratic caucus, and saying, this is what you're voting yes on. And Nancy Pelosi's been honest about this. Paul Ryan did this too. And, you know, it happened under Boehner and it goes back, but that's not how it's supposed to work. The Speaker's office historically doesn't write the legislation and just present it as a fait accompli, to the, you know, the majority. This stuff is supposed to be haggled up from below. And, but most people just don't know how to do that anymore. And the congressional leadership thinks it would be stupid or naive of them to sort of let go of the power that they have. And so, you know, most of these people don't know how to be legislators. But even with that, the idea that a member of Congress, even if you disagree with the January 6th committee, even if you, or commission, whatever it's called, even if you think the January 6th stuff is overblown, I don't, but, you know, the idea that a non-White House staffer, a member of sort of the kitchen cabinet, can defy a subpoena from Congress without Congress getting mad about it, it's just a total abdication of the role of being a representative. And, you know, what's her face? Is it Nancy Mace? You know, she at least, you know, she voted yes. And because she says she wants to have subpoena power when the Republicans take back the majority. And that's a perfect, that's, you know, it's not the reason I would hold Bannon in contempt. I hold Bannon in contempt because he's a lugubrious, you know, reptilian, hoofed, bat-winged jackass who tried to steal an election and thinks that fomenting revolution, in his own words, is really cool and nifty. But you know, in this context, you hold him in contempt because he's refusing a legitimate congressional subpoena. And you know, this raises this other thing that just sort of drives me crazy about it. About this whole stuff. I listened to the Advisory Opinions podcast, our boutique legal podcast, and it was very helpful on this executive privilege stuff. And, you know, explaining how basically executive privilege is really kind of a made up thing. I don't mean that it doesn't exist. I mean, like the law, the precedents, the rules for it have been made up sort of ad hoc since mostly since Watergate, you know, although obviously it goes back to actually goes back to George Washington. I wrote an explainer about where it comes from once during the I think the first impeachment for the Dispatch. Maybe we'll find it and put it in the show notes. It came, you know, with Washington, the reason why executive, the place where executive privilege starts is that, I think it was during the, is the J affair the same thing as the XYZ affair? I can't remember right now, but, you know, the, one of those very, very, very early American history AP scandals that plagued the Washington administration. I think it was the, I think they're the same thing. Anyway, there were ambassadors getting bribed. It was bad, or at least there were allegations of it, you know, blah, 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 blah. And in Congress, everyone in Congress was getting their dresses over their heads, and the House subpoenaed or demanded certain papers and correspondence from George Washington, who said, nope, not giving them to you. Because it was the House. He said he'd give them to the Senate because the Senate has an advise and consent role for ambassadorial appointments, and that he deemed legitimate, but the House doesn't have a right to those kinds of documents, because he has a right to keep them, you know, keep his secret documents secret. But he said, of course, in an impeachment, the Congress would have all the right to take whatever they wanted, because there is no executive privilege against impeachment. And which I thought was a very important point during the first Trump impeachment, because they were claiming executive privilege all over the place. And the House, by my lights, has every right to take any documents it wants during an impeachment proceeding. I think one of the reasons why this January 6th commission is so ass backwards is that this is the kind of commission that should have been set up and done for the first impeachment, or done for the second impeachment, for, you know, what Trump did, back in January. But Nancy Pelosi wanted to do it on the cheap. Republicans didn't want to do it at all, and they just wanted to get it over with. And so they didn't form investigatory committees. They didn't, you know, launch these kinds of, they didn't issue these kinds of subpoenas and demand witnesses, which is what they should have done during the final days of Trump's presidency. And my argument, as with the first impeachment, is that executive privilege is a largely bogus thing during an impeachment proceeding. But particularly with the Steve Bannon thing, I know I keep walking away from Steve Bannon like, you know, somebody's bothering me on a bus and I keep trying to find a new seat, but or a metaphor that actually works. But so Bannon is like a podcast host, right? He's a grifter into some other things as well, but he was not a White House advisor. He was not part of the executive branch. And the idea that you can claim executive privilege because the ex-president says that you shouldn't cooperate, when the current president says that they're waiving those executive privilege claims, I take it from, you know, the conversation with David and Sarah about how, you know, a lot of this stuff is not settled law, and there are some legal cases and precedents in Bannon's favor and all this kind of stuff. But where I just sort of get off the bus as a matter of common sense is the idea that you can invoke executive privilege to protect one of the people who is trying to orchestrate mob violence against the Congress in order to prevent the lawful transfer of power, so the president could essentially, you know, execute an auto coup or a self coup to stay in power. The idea that that is protected by executive privilege, you know, a guy who goes, there's recordings of the guy saying on, you know, there's transcripts of the guy literally saying, I guess the recordings too, saying, you know, go to Washington tomorrow. If you believe in revolution, that's where you got to be. All hell's going to break loose. Blah, 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 blah. He was part of the organizing effort to get busloads of people, angry people, to do, you know, at least some of that violence. And But even if there hadn't been violence, just the effort to intimidate Congress out of accepting the legit certifying the legitimate electors is a friggin' outrage. And like so the idea that like that Bannon should be allowed to defy Congress because the executive branch was literally part of a physical assault on the legislative branch in an effort to steal power. And with the exception of 9 Republicans, they all voted to not hold this guy in contempt or refer for criminal contempt, whatever the right phrasing is, for defying a subpoena. I mean, like, the Founding Fathers intended for Congress to jealously guard its powers and its prerogatives in the normal course of, like, the legislative process. But, like, the idea that you could unleash a mob on Congress and then the ex-president can claim executive privilege to protect one of the architects of this mob violence that was aimed directly, not figuratively, literally at the House of Representatives, is such an embarrassing and shameful, you know, expose of how little these people take their role seriously, how little they even understand their role, and how much of everything that they're doing is driven simply by, you know, Kevin McCarthy's grand quest to take back the majority. And I get that. And I'm entirely in favor of, like, or entirely resigned to, you know, parties playing hardball in the course of their normal duties. But this thing is just very, very, very different. And, I watched that new documentary about January 6th on HBO, and how you can watch that and not be furious at these jackasses, you know, whether you call it an insurrection or not, I think is kind of a red herring thing. I think they should stop. Frankly, I think they should stop calling it an insurrection, simply because it gives people permission to have a dumb argument about something rather than actually address what it obviously and indisputably was, which was a, you know, violent mob action inspired by Donald Trump's lies and to a certain extent directed by at least some of his accomplices and aides. And that's bad enough. You know, that's all you need to say about it. But you watch that thing and it just makes you angry, at least makes me angry all over again. I know there are a lot of people out there who don't get angry about January 6th at all. They only get angry at people who got angry about January 6th. But, and I guess one of the most striking things about it when you watch it, you know, there's so much video of what happened because everybody had their phones out. And some people are saying it was like one of the most videotaped, one of the most filmed events, you know, significant events in human history. And that may in fact be true when you think about it, because it was all so compact and discreet and only happened over, you know, the space of 4 or 8 hours or something like that. But what's interesting to me is, and I'd be surprised if someone isn't trying. What if you wanted to make a pro mob, pro Trump documentary about that day? Just what would it look like? You know, because all the video that you see in that is these fascistic goons, you know, talking about trying to kill cops and hang people and take over the government and say threatening and horrible and offensive things to police officers and that kind of stuff. But I'm just kind of curious, like, if there is all that video out there and presumably sort of the pro-Trump people can get some of that, you know, camera phone stuff from people that they're that are proud of what happened there, you know, what would a documentary, you know, on One America News that tried to make it seem like it was a good day and that these guys were all patriots, what would it look like? And my hunch is that you'd have to have very little footage, if any, of the storming of the Capitol, the beating of the cops with the flagpoles or any of that kind of stuff. But it'd be interesting to see someone try and just see how you would make that narrative. And it's funny because this is one of these things I often think about lots of events, about could you make a movie depicting this or that action and make what I think are the villains the heroes? And sometimes you can, you know, sometimes you can make, you know, you can certainly make, you know, movies where the Iraqis were the defenders of their homeland against these invading armies and that kind of stuff. But how close to the facts can you stick and still make, you know, the bad guys good guys or the good guys bad guys? And I often think about this in the context of the Israel-Palestinian stuff, particularly back, you know, when there was all the suicide bombers and whatnot. And it just seems to me that it would be very difficult to do a true to life, reasonably accurate depiction of Palestinian suicide bombers walking into pizza joints and blowing up teenagers and making them into the heroes, making them seem like the good guys. It'd be very difficult to make a movie with, you know, anything like, again, sticking to the facts and seeming like it was loyal to history, where you're indiscriminately lobbing, you know, missiles into playgrounds and whatnot. I'm not saying that you couldn't make a movie that depicts Israelis bad. That I'm sure that's been done a million times. But, you know, how close to the truth, you know, how far from the truth do you have to get in order to do that? And anyway, so I don't know why I got onto that. And since we're on Bannon, kind of, sort of, I guess I should talk for a second about the new truth social media thing. I have very little confidence that this thing is going to survive. But maybe it will, you know. If you don't know, Trump is launching a alternative to Twitter, because, you know, that's the most important thing, is that he have an outlet for his social media needs. And it's funny, if you look at the stuff from the deck, you know, the pitch deck, there is almost nothing in there about like revenue or cash flow or any of this kind of stuff. You know, I mean, Steve are having a fun time with this because, you know, we were two journalists who had to put together, with some help, you know, a deck, you know, basically just as a presentation, like a PowerPoint kind of thing, to raise money to launch the Dispatch. And we had lots more stuff about, like, you know, profit and loss and revenue streams and projected income. But supposedly this billionaire genius guy, with this massive funding for this thing, doesn't seem particularly concerned about that, even though it wants to be a publicly traded company. But I think the funniest thing about it is, I think it's Rule 23. Let me see. If you go to truthsocial.com and you look at their terms of service, it says that you may not disparage, tarnish, or otherwise harm, in our opinion, us and or the site. Now, what I love about this, I want to, you know, give it, you know, flowers and invite it to my condo in Port Arthur, Texas, love, is that you have all of these people out there talking about how big tech censorship is bad. Big tech censorship, you know, is destroying us. Just this morning, I'll read it to you because I have that sort of open. This guy from this clown show thing called American Moment tweets out a op-ed by J.D. Vance and Blake Masters in the New York Post. And this guy, Sarab Sharma, I think is his name. Apologies if I don't pronounce it correctly, but he's with, he's the president of American Moment and one of these guys that is, you know, one of these new nationalist, you know, Claire Monster creatures that, you know, whatever. But anyway, he tweeted this morning, two kings, J.D. Vance and Blake Masters, on one of the existential issues of our time, the chains of corporate slavery under tech oligarchy. First of all, they're not kings. It's not an existential issue. It's not even close to an existential issue. It would have to take two buses and a train to get near an existential issue. And there are no chains of corporate slavery at work here. But these guys have spun themselves up into believing an enormous amount of nonsense. You know, it's funny not to get into the whole sort of argumentum ad Hitlerum thing. I'm not saying these guys are fascist, but I will say I'm not saying that they're not fascists. You know, I've still got to do this big sort of updating of liberal fascism to take account for all of this stuff, including a lot of stuff that I was wrong about. But this kind of language about this, you know, corporate slavery under tech oligarchy, that is very similar to the kind of talk that you got in the 1920s from the early Nazi movement and in Italy from the, you know, early fascist movement. All of, you know, back then, there was the department stores that were considered the masters of, you know, the oligarchs and that kind of thing. In the United States, too, a lot of that sort of Father Coughlin social justice movement was against department stores. The reason why department stores were considered so evil, sort of like how, you know, reminiscent a little bit of the Walmart, you know, Costco kind of arguments of today, but different. But one of the reasons why department stores were considered so evil is that they put out of business a lot of general stores. And general stores, particularly in rural communities, weren't just like hubs for the community in all sorts of good and positive and nice ways. They were also essentially banks for a lot of people, where you could buy on credit seed for next year's harvest, or supplies for next year's, you know, harvest, or supplies for your shop on credit, on spec. And then when you brought your finished goods or your crops to market, you pay back, you know, the guy. Department stores didn't do that kind of layaway, that kind of credit. And they were also much further away from all of these places. So like the department stores were seen as sort of evil impositions and all the rest. Anyway, the way, you know, if you go back, I'm sure it would take me about 10 minutes to find, you know, speeches by, Hitler and the early, you know, brown shirt types, about, you know, there was a lot of stuff about interest slavery and corporate slavery and capitalist slavery and all of these kinds of things, that had nothing to do with actual slavery. And, you know, people forget, you know, just because communists were anti-capitalist and anti-business, didn't mean that fascists weren't either. But anyway, so the thing that supposedly gets these guys, their blood pumping is the censorship on Twitter and Facebook. It makes them very, very, very angry. And sometimes they're right to be angry. Some of the stuff that, you know, the big tech guys do to censor is really bad. Like, you know, Amazon taking that book about transgender stuff, off its virtual shelves, I thought was outrageous, you know? But, you know, a lot of the stuff that Twitter and Facebook bans does not bother me at all, because having some, you know, some censorship is necessary. Otherwise, everything would just simply be porn. But anyway, for them, censorship is like the most evil, most terrible thing. We must create our own platforms where we don't have censorship. And yet, Rule 23 of Truth Media says you cannot disparage, tarnish, or otherwise harm, in our opinion, us and or the site. So in other words, you can't make fun of Trump. You can't make fun of the site. You can't make fun of people Trump likes or people who are working at Truth Social or whatever. And that's it. That's like, that's the standard for censorship there. And it's amazing to me that like this sort of self-beclowning hasn't gotten more attention from, you know, the we must throw off the shackles of corporate slavery and censorship crowd, because it's proven the point. I mean, when Parler, or is it Parlay? I don't know. And I don't really give a rat's ass. When that thing launched, you know, they were going to be the super free speech place. And then all of a sudden they were swamped by neo-Nazis and porn. And so they started, you know, censoring people. The stuff is hard. But, you know, if you're going to make opposition to censorship your ne plus ultra or sine qua non or some other fancy Latin phrase, you know, having it in your rules of service that you can't say mean things about us kind of undermines the whole project. All right, what else? I've said a zillion times on here that the era of hawkishness with China is baked into the cake, and the only question is whether or not we're going to have smart hawkishness or dumb hawkishness. And I still believe that, but I got to say, you know, I've tried not to be too alarmist about China. I'm starting to get kind of alarmist or alarmed. I think the hypersonic missile thing is a big deal. It's a really, really big deal. It, you know, particularly when it's in conjunction with China making all of these sounds and moves about taking back Taiwan. And you hear every now and then people say, well, it's just saber rattling and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, but saber rattling is in fact really dangerous. Saber rattling can invite saber rattling from other people, and then all of a sudden you've got Fred Thompson on the deck of a aircraft carrier saying, you know, this is going to get out of control and people are going to die. Most bad police shootings come from sort of heightened tensions where people are quick to assume the worst of the other player. And so the fact that they're willing to do this kind of saber rattling and very serious saber rattling is very worrisome to me. And the hypersonic missile, you should really read Klon Kitchen's piece for us explaining it all, but the short version is most missiles, most of our sort of big intercontinental ballistic missiles, they go up and then they go down, right? So it's like this parabolic, I guess is what you call the trajectory. It's very predictable, it's interceptable. And the thing about this hypersonic thing is I gather it goes, it may not go as fast, but, which is weird given its name, but it can change its course on the way. And it can also come up for specific reasons. It can come up from the south and sort of hit us from, in effect, from behind, where almost all of our anti-missile stuff has been stationed and focused on Russia. So there's a lot of it, you know, in Alaska and that kind of stuff. This could come up from across the southern border, you know, where the sun doesn't shine kind of thing. And you had this guy who was the cybersecurity expert for the Pentagon quit because he says, basically, we've lost to China in the AI department. I still don't completely understand how a lot of the AI works or the quantum computing works or why it's the whole ball game. But all the people I know who know about this stuff say it kind of is. And, you know, the problem with China is that, like, I am still of a school that, you know, people keep saying that the experiment with getting China richer and that leading to democracy has failed. And I still don't say that. I don't see it that way. I still see it as it hasn't worked yet. And that doesn't mean that we should, you know, just give it more time and let China do its thing or any of that kind of stuff. That's not my point. I think there are legitimate reasons to bring a lot of supply chain stuff home, particularly when it comes to stuff like chips. I can get into a thing with Scott Linsicum about it. I shouldn't say bring it all home. I just mean get it out of China. I just don't think they're a reliable or safe trading partner for a lot of these kinds of things for a while. But I still do actually believe in this general pattern, which has borne itself out time and time again, that once you get a certain level of wealth, and particularly among a middle class, that will eventually yield a fight for the rule of law and democracy. It's taking longer, and it looks like it's going to take much longer still for it to work in China. But I still believe that that possibility is still there. I still think the Chinese Communist Party is more brittle than we give it credit for, or than we tend to think. You know, one of the reasons why they're doing all of this, you know, panopticon, social credit score, totalitarian data mining stuff, is because they're scared, right? This is not something that ruling parties do because they're confident about their future. It's something that they do because they're scared they might lose power. And again, I'm not saying that this is the mindset of everybody in there, but it's, if you had the full and complete support of the populace, you wouldn't need to do a lot of this stuff. There was a fascinating piece. I can't remember the place. Was it Quillette? Not Quillette. Someplace like Quillette. About basically the chief ideologist of the Chinese Communist Party and his concerns about the West. And I'm not going to find it. My brain's just not working. But he was basically like the Suslov. Suslov was the chief ideologist of the old Soviet Politburo. And this guy studied in the West, used to be very pro-liberalization under Deng Xiaoping, and then over time basically came to agree with me in the sense that building a strong, vibrant middle class over time undermines social, the social cohesion that you get from a totalitarian government. And he thought this was bad. He looks at America and says, America is, look how decadent it is and self-hating it is and all that kind of stuff, which he's got a point there. We don't want to do that. So we need to keep this kind of liberalization at bay. And you can have a certain amount of economic liberalization, but you cannot have political liberalization. And my argument is that economic liberalization over time yields political liberalization. And this is this was the argument of Seymour Martin Lipset and his modernization theory. And this was the argument of Karl Marx. Right. Karl Marx argued that you needed to have a bourgeois revolution before you could have a proletarian revolution. He was pretty much right about the bourgeois revolution part, is that the way you get rid of feudalism, the way you get rid of the ancien regime, aristocratic order and monarchy and that kind of thing, is you get a big enough middle class and a bourgeois. And bourgeois, and I know I say bourgeois a lot on here, it just means it's derived from basically the word burger, not like hamburger, but like the burgers of of Dresden or whatever, it basically means city dweller. But more specifically, it means mildly affluent city dweller. And one of the reasons why it took on that connotation is that, cities in the old days, so to some extent still today, not as much, I guess. Cities is where people would bring raw commodities, and then artisans, craftsmen, guilds, these kinds of people would turn them into finished goods, right? So you bring in your cattle, and out come, handbags and shoes and hamburgers and steaks. You bring in your wheat, out comes bread and pasta. You bring in lumber, out come, you know, bring in trees, out comes lumber and everything else that they make with wood, right? And these middlemen were essential, and the middlemen are, they're also the distribution hubs to send this stuff back out to other places for trade. And that's why cities got rich. Cities had the benefit of division of labor. They had large numbers of people. The one of my favorite phrases from medieval Europe is, I'm gonna mess this up, but I believe it is Stutloft macht du frei, which is city air makes you free. And it used to have actually a literal meaning, which was that if you were like a serf and you fled your traditional home, you know, where you were by law basically an indentured servant or quasi-slave, if you could make it to a city and you could be there for, I think often the term was a year and a day, you became a free citizen and you couldn't be expatriated, you know, if they didn't catch you. But there's a sort of a more poetic meaning to city air makes you free, is because like cities are where people go to escape. Historically, it's where they go to escape the bonds of traditionalism and custom and expectations of their elders and their church or whatever, and try to sort of sculpt their own lives and make, you know, and become who they are or who they want to be. And how did I get on this? Oh, I was trying to explain just bourgeois. So anyway, I still think that China could become a liberal democracy someday, but my timeline for that is much longer than I would like. And in the process, a lot of bad things can happen. And I'm more and more, I'm fearing that bad things will happen. You know, part of the problem is that, you know, China has a lot of excess men. And wherever you have too many men, there's a tendency towards violence. You know, in the, one of the reasons why the Wild West was so wild is that you had, too many men and not enough women. And one of the things that men do, because men are idiots, is they start performatively combating with other men to impress females. But that kind of impulse also translates itself into politics. And you can find, you know, that the attraction of nationalism becomes much stronger in those kinds of societies, because you have you know, disgruntled young men who feel like the world is against them. I mean, this whole incel thing in the United States is sort of kind of proof of that. And we know that when authoritarian regimes feel threatened internally, what they do is they find external foes to blame everything on. Middle East has been doing did this with Israel for decades. Russia does this on a constant basis. You know, they, as Leon Aron likes to say, you know, Russia thinks it's been at war with the West for 20 years now. I mean, that's what their propaganda, that their news, that's what Putin, you know, Putin's whole pitch is that, you know, we could have better things, but the West is constantly trying to undermine us, and I alone am strong enough to stand up to it. This is, you know, why the Iranians talk about the great Satan and all that. Go down a very long list. And so China, in order to sort of keep people's minds off the fact that their economy is starting to slow down, or that people's, you know, social status anxiety is not being satiated by capitalism because they can't get a wife or they can't leave their farms or whatever, creating a nationalist threat or a nationalist movement is very much in Xi's and the Communist Party's interest. And I do wish, you know, like last night, I basically agreed with most of what Pompeo was saying last night in this interview on Special Report, but I wish conservatives would stop whenever they're talking about, you know, China or even North Korea, stop talking about, oh, this is perfectly consistent with their Marxist Leninist, you know, agenda, or this, you know, you kept saying Marxist Leninist or Marxist Leninism and whatnot. There's precious little to nothing with the exception of one party rule of China. There's nothing Marxist Leninist about China anymore. It's authoritarian. It's neo-authoritarian. I mean, we come up with some label that's accurate, but you know, its economy does not look anything like Marxist Leninism. They don't talk about Marxist Leninism very much, except to the most ridiculous rubes. It's, you know, it's a Chinese thing now. And, you know, and North Korea, I've talked about this a bunch, has taken all the Marxism and Leninism verbiage out of their documents and their charter and constitution years ago. That place is essentially just a monarchy trying to get nuclear weapons. So anyway, I kind of think that the hypersonic missile thing combined with Taiwan should be viewed as at least somewhat like a kind of a Sputnik moment. You know, I think we should be thinking really, really hard about what we're willing to do and what we're not willing to do to defend Taiwan, to stand up to China before it's too late. And I think the opportunities for really stupid decision-making all around are really, really strong. And I want to write about this Jen Psaki thing, but just to put a pin in it, like Jen Psaki, when confronted with this news about the when asked about this thing with the hypersonic missile and Taiwan and their arms build up and China and whatever, she says, we welcome competition, but we don't want it to turn into conflict. And we talked about this a bit on the Dispatch podcast, but this is like incredibly stupid. Just on the merits. I mean, it just is powerfully, palpably stupid. Because it's completely contradictory to everything, particularly Democrats have said for the last 40 years or so, maybe since JFK, in the sense that, you know, certainly since the 80s, there's a big swath, and Obama was part of it, right? You know, starting with like the Sane Freeze movement. There's always been a very strong element on the foreign policy left and among foreign policy, just conventional liberals too, that arms races are really what are like the source of so many of our problems, and that they're dangerous. They are dangerous, right? But they also sometimes are good. I think it was Churchill. No, it wasn't Churchill. Gosh, there was somebody famous said that we got into World War I because of an arms race, and we got into World War II because we didn't have an arms race. You know, sometimes building up weapons is a good thing. And like, so Reagan's military buildup made the world safer, not less safe. And you know, when it is clear that the United States is the dominant and unmatchable superpower, military superpower on the planet, and that we are willing to demonstrate that if called upon, it puts a wet blanket on a lot of bad actors and, you know, and a lot of mischief. But when we signal that either we do not have the capability or we are not willing to use the capability, that's when bad things happen. It's the same logic of like friggin' every single like prison movie and mobster movie since the dawn of time. It's like if people suspect weakness, they start pressing their advantages. If they think, you know, you don't have game anymore, they try to take your territory. I mean, this is like half of, you know, like the drug dealers in The Wire so completely understand this logic better than an enormous number of foreign policy intellectuals. And so anyway, but you know, the idea that you would say in response to the Chinese making a massive leap forward, apparently much further along than we are in developing a hypersonic missile that will one day be able to carry a thermonuclear warhead aimed at the United States of America, which would in effect make it very difficult for us to do anything about Taiwan or any place else that China's interested in dominating without risking, you know, a nuclear confrontation. The idea that a liberal Democrat speaking for a liberal Democrat administration would say, we welcome the competition, is just mind-bogglingly dumb. It's weird. I mean, I'm a free market guy, and you know, and if China had the politics and the political culture of Hong Kong, let's just say it was like Hong Kong. I was going to say like like the UK or Mexico or something, but you know, Hong Kong is even better. I'd be fine with as much competition on a bunch of things with them, because I don't think that like trading with China makes, you know, trading with a peaceful and democratic China would be only to the plus side for the United States of America. I do not buy any of the Trumpian protectionist arguments about how trade makes us poor or any of that kind of stuff. But trading with China when it's, you know, aiding and abetting an authoritarian regime with hegemonic ambitions, that's a different story. Nonetheless, I could still totally understand saying we welcome competition when it came to something like flat screen TVs or jetpacks, or sitcoms or movies or whatever. But the idea that we welcome competition in a nuclear arms race is weird. It's just weird. And I haven't seen her clean this thing up very well yet either, which is to me weirder still. And it's particularly weird when we're not talking about actually joining in the competition in a serious way and throwing a lot of money at building up our own capacities in this regard. I don't like the concept of Sputnik moments generally. I hated when Obama talked about it, because basically it was just a stand-in for moral equivalent to war stuff. And, you know, and in particular, I can't hold this against Obama personally, since he wasn't alive, or at least he wasn't, you know, like politically a real person yet. But a lot of the people who love to talk about Sputnik moments are the very people who their ideological stripe had problems with the actual Sputnik moment. It's this constant tendency to love the moral equivalent of war when it's for your ends, but not liking actual, you know, military strategic competition with when it's actually called for. And don't get me started on the moral equivalent of war thing. I should probably do a whole like interstitial or, you know, supplemental thing on the moral equivalent of war, because there's very few sort of eggheadish things I have read and written about more. I apologize if I seem like I'm just sort of phoning it in today. I'm not phoning it in. I'm just distracted, and the dog thing really put me in a foul mood. What put me in a great mood though was visiting my daughter out in California. It was really just a great time. I was very worried. Now, so my daughter and I have this thing about amusement parks. We do roller coasters together, in part because my wife will not do them. So we've been doing that since she was a little girl, and it's a little weird. You know, I still feel like it was only a year or two that we had to worry about whether or not she was tall enough for certain rides. But of course that was a long time ago. But so partly on the advice of Charlie Cook, British Charlie Cook, not cephalologist Charlie Cook, we opted to go to the Six Flags in Valencia at the Magic Mountain and not Disneyland. And that was also in part because I looked, you couldn't get into any of the Disneyland hotels except for, I kid you not, the main hotel in Disneyland. And I was booking, like trying to book like 3 weeks out. The only rooms left were these suites that started at like $13,000 a night. And You know, look, I mean, I love Harry Shave, but those ads do not provide that kind of money. So, you know, I didn't want to do that. And also, like, but as Charlie pointed out, if you're in it for the rides rather than the sort of the nostalgia and the Americana stuff, then Six Flags just crushes Disneyland. Which I take him at his word at, in part because I haven't been to Disneyland in like 40 years or something. But also because like Disney World, you know, the rides themselves aren't as good as like some other amusement parks. But also I take Charlie's word for it because Charlie is an insane roller coaster nerd. Like he can tell you the names of the firms that built certain roller coasters and when they built them and why they built them the certain way and all this kind of stuff. And he is, you know, he's an obsessive about it. It's really kind of funny. And so we went to Magic Mountain and I was really worried. I'm having real bad back issues. I got to get some physical therapy. Pretty sure it's just straight up sciatica or some, you know, whatever they call it these days. I was really worried that, you know, all these roller coasters were going to like mess up my back something vicious. But it turned out, I don't know if it was the compression or whatever, but it worked out fine and it wasn't really a problem. But man, some of those roller coasters are amazing. The single best one, maybe the best roller coaster I've ever been on, with the exception maybe of like the Cyclone for nostalgia's sake, is this one. I think it's called Twisted Colossus, and which claims to marry sort of the best parts of wood roller coasters with steel roller coasters. And there's something about the free fall on this thing that even though it's not like legitimately a free fall ride the way, you know, some rides are, it's just unbelievable and just a crazy, crazy roller coaster. But anyway, so we had a lovely time, stayed in a hotel on Sunset Boulevard, which was kind of kitschy and weird. I had long talks with my kid, which was wonderful. And, you know, and it's interesting. I'm hearing this from other friends who have kids who are starting college this year and, you know, have daughters in particular. And I'm going to stay so far from betraying any of the confidences that my daughter and I have about talking about particularly her social life. But it's interesting. There's a common refrain about how, first of all, it's a little tougher for girls to find their place than it is for boys because, you know, give them a red solo cup full of beer and they're off to the races. But it does seem, you know, it does seem like the pandemic stuff has had an effect, that there are just a lot of kids who are struggling to sort of navigate social waters and a little bit of normalcy. And I'm kind of proud of how well, you know, my kid's doing with all of that. But it was just really interesting to get a sense, like, it's just some of the stuff, particularly men are willing to admit to and say and do, are so alien to me in terms of, you know, the way I grew up. And, you know, I kept telling my daughter, I was like, you know, look, I went to an all women's college. You know, it's not like I went to, you know, Texas A&M and was a frat bro or something. But even so, like, the sort of sensitivity, I don't want to say snowflakiness, but, you know, the sort of coddling of the American mind stuff, I think is real. And I think that the pandemic and made it even more acute in some ways. But I hear different reports from different people, you know, and, but, you know, there's sort of this thing that parents do. I'm sure some of you are familiar with it. When your first kid or only kid goes to college, you start comparing notes with other people. And I just keep hearing sort of similar stories from people. Anyway, I am going to write a little bit about that Jen Psaki thing, I think, in the G file, because it ties into this other thing I want to write about, which is that MIT story. What else was I going to tell you people about? I mentioned the other day this new community based thingamabob, whatchamacallit, that we're developing. We'll probably put something in the Wednesday G file next week, because the beta testing thing, to the extent we're going to do it that way, is going to be for paid members only, you know, because the actual thing will be for paid members only as well. We think we have a real strategic advantage with how good, for the most part, our comment section is, and our comment sections are, if that's the better grammar. I talk goodly. And we want to give a even richer, more robust experience. And some of the stuff that this thing can do when we're fully staffed and built up is really cool. Like, I can just simply, like, with a button as an administrator, launch a video and say, I could send out the G file and then say, you know, 10 minutes from now, you know, I'm going to pop on this in the comment section in video, ask me anything kind of thing. I mean, it's like really cool stuff. And there's one button that opens a silo in Nebraska and launches an intercontinental ballistic missile, which I'm really hoping to use at one point. But no, it's going to be cool. And, you know, we just got one step at a time kind of thing. And a bunch of people have asked me if Charlie Cook come back on so we can talk about this third party stuff. Charlie and I have been texting throughout this whole thing about all sorts of things, including this third party stuff. And as I said before, I had Michael Brendan Doherty on. The original plan was to have Charlie on, but Charlie couldn't do it. And so we got an Irishman to do it. I thought some people were a little too uncharitable towards Michael. But, you know, it was in the comments and the feedback I got. But I thought the end of that conversation was actually really, really interesting. And the, but the problem was, is he, for whatever reason, didn't want to engage on the third party stuff very much. But Charlie does. Charlie's chomping at the bit to explain to me why I'm wrong, which I think is fine. And I can talk to him about roller coaster stuff too. So we're going to figure out how to get him on, if not this coming week, then certainly soon thereafter. Next week, I got Paul Bloom coming on. I'm very excited about this. He's one of my two favorite psychologist eggheads, the other one being Jonathan Haidt. I've learned a lot from Bloom. He's got a new book out. I'm going to spend the weekend reading it, and really looking forward to that. I highly recommend his other books, but we'll talk about more about that next week. And I'm going to try to see Dune this weekend, and that's all I got, I guess. So I'll see you next time.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.